You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
You know, related to cross-border trade and integration of, say, electricity grids or pipeline grids, there are some issues on the border we haven't really talked about. One of them involves water management. We have multiple shared resources in water, some that flow south, some that flow north, some that flow west to east, aquifers that run underground between the two countries, some of which are in commerce with the Rio Grande. And we've done a tremendous job since 1944 in jointly managing those resources. But we could do an even better job because it's one of those opportunities for collaborative border relationships where what, say, one does on one side of the border can actually be mutually beneficial for both. So deforestation upstream in the Colorado River actually affects net downflow and the amount of water available to be then divvied up at the border. And so thinking about these water resources in terms of comprehensive watershed management, the way we might think about the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence River, is a tremendous step forward, and we could do even more than the International Boundary and Water Commission has already done to strengthen that relationship, including not only volume of water, but water quality. And then I won't go into greater detail, but obviously, you know, there are issues of offshore drilling and management of the Gulf of Mexico, in which there are further opportunities for collaboration. So when we widen the aperture of the border and don't just think about trade or security, there's many more opportunities for mutually beneficial collaboration. In terms of the Merida money, my answer is yes. Yes, all of it. A marginal dollar invested in Mexican law enforcement capacity does more for American security than a marginal dollar invested in the U.S. Border Patrol right now. And there are many things that could be done in Mexico to strengthen the rule of law, decreasing impunity. A federal witness program would be wonderful, obviously more on the prosecutorial and penitentiary side in Mexico, and those would be tremendous tremendously valuable investments for the United States to help make southern border as well. But to me, the Mexican government has done a tremendous job of investing in the federal police, including vetted units, as well as in the sort of takedown marine units that are sequestered. What's a little bit lagging, I think, is the judicial, prosecutorial, penitentiary side of things. And that's what most needs to be reinforced right now. If we're offering prescriptions for the other country, in a sense, those seem to loom at the top of the list. Though from our own perspective, obviously, we have work to do as well. But if you're thinking about merit money and marginal dollars best invested, that's where I would put it.
I would just add for the Merida and foreign aid, and we've already seen some of this happen, the focus in the beginning was just police, law enforcement training and equipment. It's now expanded to train prosecutors, but also some of those social infrastructure needs, building resilient communities, very critical, helping youth along the border, violence prevention, building up local businesses, helping families. That really does pay off, and not just immediately, but for generations to come.
So I think the Merida issue has been fully addressed. I would just say capacity building and being more flexible with the Merida resources is important for the reasons that have already been articulated. On the issue of other examples, I mean, again, they've been addressed. But what I would say is this is why I refer to the border region as an ecosystem, whether it's medical device technology, whether it's, you mentioned automotives, solar energy. You know, SunPower, one of the most prominent solar energy firms in the world, is making the most innovative solar panels in the world in Mexicali, right? And it goes on and on from there. I was down in the El Paso region. You know, the VA has just opened a new hospital that's focused on traumatic brain injury, and the Borderplex Alliance down there, is trying to figure out how do you create a cluster around treating medical care around traumatic brain injury using that hospital as an anchor. So, Chris and the North American Research Partnership in Arizona, the Wilson Center, just put out a report on cluster mapping, clusters in the border region. So, again, this goes to my basic point, which is if we think about the border as bridges and ports of entry, as a place where we have to move goods and services, and as pass-through communities, we're missing half of the equation at least. The border itself is a place of dynamic economic growth and innovation, and there are plenty of stories. Those stories are just not being told. I remember, for example, just to wrap up, I was traveling with President Obama to Mexico when he gave, when the first time he met President Peña Nieto, we went down to the Palacio Nacional, and after the bilateral meeting in Mexico City, he asked me to go to Querétaro to visit. We were going to take the message and amplify it out. And I had a chance to not only meet the governor and some of the leaders in Querétaro, but I visited GE's research center in Querétaro. GE, the iconic American manufacturer. And what I learned was that GE engineers, jet aircraft engineers, Mexican engineers, were designing and innovating on GE's aircraft designs. And those design elements were being sent back to the United States and manufactured in places like Ohio and South Carolina and in manufacturing states in the United States. So it sort of flipped the whole idea of NAFTA on its head, right? That Mexican engineers were providing the intellectual capital that was then leading to blue-collar jobs in the United States. I mean, those stories just aren't told, you know? That has facilitated, you know, billions of dollars in revenue for GE as it expands its sales throughout the Americas. And there are other examples at 3M and other places. So I think that the fundamental point is we got to see the relationship more holistically. And finally, to the question about, you know, what can be done, you mentioned the president's reform. And Mexico continues to reform and improve the indicators on the doing business, you know, in standards and whatnot. What I think something that is will put you all to sleep if I mention it, and it's boring and policy wonkish, but, you know, regulatory cooperation is hugely important. You've got industries that are collaborating that are cross-border in nature, and yet we've got still have different standards for, you know, that the manufacturers have to meet. If we could further deepen the harmonization of standards and other regulations so that you could have one economic zone for manufacturing, for example, or for providing services, that would dramatically improve the competitiveness. And there are, you know, institutional relationships and the bilateral relationship to focus on that. But again, it's so wonky, people get bored by it. But it's hugely important. If you talk to captains of industry in this space, that's what they want, right after better borders.
Thank you. And I think we still have a couple more minutes before Senator John Cornyn and Ambassador Sarikhan take the stage for the final concluding conversation of this event today. But I want to pick up on this point that you've mentioned on collaboration, because you talked about what the U.S. could do, government could do, what the Mexican government could do. We talked about private sector collaboration, but I know there's some initiatives for more collaboration between the governments. And I think you just pointed to regulatory harmonization. If you could put that in the context of maybe the TPP discussions between the two governments, and to what extent do those kinds of conversations, are those conversations now being blown up to like an even bigger stage with more countries? And Chapel, you've actually also talked about collaborative security, joint inspection facilities. We heard from Congressman Hurd this morning. And you know, what are the opportunities for that kind of collaboration between the two governments to issue these policies? And so if we could just quickly touch on those issues, and Angela, if you want to jump in at the local level or things that you've seen actually work in terms of, you know, border city collaboration, because, I mean, there are governments across both sides of the border at the local and state levels that, of course, work together occasionally.
Sure. Well, what I would say is, despite the political rhetoric, this is actually in some ways we're at a pinnacle of cooperation between the U.S. And Mexican governments. You know, since NAFTA, I used to say when I was in government that I felt that the relationship was kind of on autopilot. But starting a few years ago, we began to recognize the importance of really creating infrastructure, platforms that would force our governments at the highest levels to get together and talk about issues of competitiveness. It's insane that the United States, Canada, and Mexico don't get together and talk meaningfully about how we compete as a regional economic bloc, how we address the rise of China, how we compete with the European Union, how we compete with the emerging economies in the ASEAN or APEC region. And so we've finally begun to do that in a really meaningful way. And to your point, the high-level economic dialogue was established in 2013. And through the HLED, as we call it, there are, you know, there's very specific emphasis at the highest levels. I mean, Vice President Biden, Secretary Pritzker, the Secretary of Energy, and others were just down in Mexico City just a couple weeks ago talking about these issues. And I think the TPP is the next extension of that relationship. It definitely multilateralizes it, if you will. But just in the bilateral context, there's a lot of deep cooperation that's trying to help break some of the log jams that exist that have held up some of these issues for some time.
So I think we're just about ready to start the next segment of the program. Maybe I can just get 30 seconds from each of you if you want to jump in on this.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we are at a pinnacle in a sense, but we're not at the highest peak. And let me try to sketch out very briefly what I think the highest peak looks like. It, first of all, paradigmatically, it's a shift away from a 19th century notion of the border and of sovereignty as managing a line in the sand to a more collaborative approach that sees mutual benefit in managing a shared border. And we don't think about doing everything at the physical boundary itself, but rather wherever it's most efficient to do so, and that encompasses trade, law enforcement, and a bunch of other spheres. What does that look like, say, in the most wonkish and boring level at a port of entry? It looks like a single building with an open floor plan right along the border itself, straddling the boundary with a little dotted red line along the middle of the border, along the middle of the building, indicating the border itself. And if not cross-deputized officers, at least officers from both sides in the same building doing single-entry processing and able to communicate with each other real-time while looking at more or less the same information on their screens. That is, in a sense, I guess, the physical manifestation of collaborative border management in the 21st century.
And I'll be very, very brief. We need to continue this discussion, and we, the Cronkite School of Journalism and two major media partners, we're going to be doing polling on both sides of the border, up and down the border, to find out what border residents want, give some perspective, some opinions, some solutions, and we'll be doing stories, and this will be released before both of the conventions this summer, so we'll have some real voices to add to this debate.
Fantastic. Well, please join me in thanking our panelists for a great conversation. And I invite Ambassador Sarah Cohn and Senator John Cornyn to take the stage.
Good morning. It's good to see that you've been able to battle the metro chaos out there today. It took me a bit to drive down. And I apologize to my fellow panelists this morning. I was coming from a Senate panel yesterday in Mexico City and flying through Atlanta. My last flight into D.C. got canceled and I had to sleep in Atlanta, so I was able to grab a flight early this morning, shower, change, and then make it on time. So I apologize for not being with you for the beginning of the program. But it's a huge pleasure and honor to be here today joining my good friend, Senator John Cornyn of Texas. And I say this not because we're in Washington and everyone says, you know, my good friend, the esteemed or the honorable X or Y. John Cornyn and I worked hand in hand for 6 years during my tenure as an ambassador to the United States. And this is no easy task. This is a complex, challenging relationship, as you've heard. No bilateral relationship the United States has with any country on the face of the earth. There's so many moving parts. And Texas obviously plays a central role in this bilateral relationship. I've always said that Texas has historically been the spark plug of the U.S.-Mexico bilateral relationship. And John Cornyn and the former senator of Texas, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, have played a unique role in pushing forward and modernizing and upgrading this bilateral relationship between both countries. And look, the senator and I sometimes disagreed on issues, as is obvious on a relationship like the one that we have. But what always, always was the mark of the day was the ability to sit down to discuss, based on facts, not on fiction. These days, with a candidate out there who is Teflon-coated to hard data, who's a walking fact-free zone, and whose facts are as loose as his lips, it is very gratifying that there are statesmen like Senator John Cornyn in the Senate today, engaged in the day-to-day dynamics of what is probably one of the most important relationships for the security, the prosperity, and the future well-being of Texans and of Americans. So what we will do today is the senator will address, will provide some opening remarks from the podium, then we'll sit down, have a bit of a chat, a conversation, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. So, Senator, so good to have you here with us today.
Well, thanks, Mr. Ambassador. It's great to be with you and look forward to our conversation. Let me express my gratitude to Brookings for hosting this, and it is very important to have these sorts of informed discussions about policies affecting the United States and Mexico and our common border, because we are dependent on one another in so many ways. Occasionally when I'm in Mexico or even in Texas, I'll talk about this being like a marriage. We can't get a divorce. We've got to make it work. And it takes both of us, the United States and Mexico, working together. And the truth is, for example, the United States has about 6 million jobs that benefit from binational trade with Mexico. And so our prosperity depends in large part on the prosperity of Mexico and our relationship. So, and I might add, Texas and Mexico do have some history. You don't have to go that far back. The Senate seat I hold was first held by Sam Houston. He came to the Senate in 1846 after Texas became a state. So we do have some history. I know you've had earlier panelists, people like Beto O'Rourke and Will Hurd, speak to you. And it's great to see in a very polarized Washington, D.C., the bipartisan cooperation and work that we do together that I think really distinguishes the Texas delegation. I work very closely with Henry Cuellar on many, many issues as well. So despite the partisan differences that seem to be emblematic of what's happening in Washington and maybe in our politics in general, I just want to reassure you that there are those of us who do believe that it's important to work together in a bipartisan, bicameral way and to work with our friends in Mexico and, of course, in the United States to improve our relationship, because it is for our mutual benefit that we do so. So there's trade, obviously, is a huge component of that relationship, and I'd just like to note a few things that have happened recently that I think are really landmarks in that developing issue, trade. The opening of the West Rail International Bridge, for example, last summer. This is the first new international bridge between the United States and Mexico in over a century. And then there's the launch of the pre-inspection pilot program at Laredo National Airport, the only place outside of Mexico City where international cargo bound for Mexico can be inspected. And, of course, last month we celebrated the completion of the Tornillo Guadalupe Land Port of Entry, now the largest border crossing along the entire southern border, and a testament to the hard work of leaders in El Paso County. These accomplishments would not have happened without leadership from, frankly, a lot of Texans that I'm very proud of. And again, on a bipartisan, bicameral basis. And because we do have a front row seat in what happens along the border, we have obviously very much of a vested interest. But this isn't just about, as I hope to impress upon you, the border is not just a local issue. It's not just an issue between Texas and Mexico or Arizona, New Mexico, California. These are everybody's issues because the prosperity, as I said earlier, of our two countries benefits both of us. We did, for example, pass legislation that is very important to our to the infrastructure issue. And no, Mr. Ambassador, it's not about the wall. I am talking about a long-term transportation bill, the first time in a decade. This legislation provides state and city leaders the certainty needed to address our long-term transportation challenges. And if you go to the border, let's say in Laredo, where it's the largest land port of entry in the United States, you'll see a lot of trucks stacked up there, not good for commerce, not good for the environment, not good for trade. And so infrastructure is important. We've also been able to engage in some public-private partnerships that allow the cities and communities, local governments there to contribute to efforts, whether it's staffing or whether it's other infrastructure development, to help facilitate those cross-border issues. I know this group knows how important quality infrastructure is. One report recently found that $116 million in U.S. economic output is lost every minute a truck sits idle at the border, $116 million U.S. dollars. And in Texas, that border infrastructure moves about $100 billion of exports to Mexico each year alone. And, of course, quality infrastructure is also important because our border crossings are the first line of defense against bad actors who want to exploit those borders. And we also know that it's not just about the United States and Mexico. What happens south of Mexico also has a big impact on the United States. And, of course, I'm referring to the unaccompanied minor children coming in from Central America, which has been called, and I think appropriately so, a humanitarian crisis. And this is, unfortunately, you know, as I reflect on what's happening in Central America and my visits to there, I guess about a year ago now, I was in Honduras and San Pedro Sula, and I think we could say the most dangerous neighborhood and the most dangerous city and the most dangerous country in the world. And people ask, well, why would a mother put her young boy or young daughter, turn them over into the hands of a criminal organization that would offer to transport them from their home in Central America to the United States? What must life be like in Honduras, for example, or in Central America, that you would risk that? Well, it must be pretty bad. And so it's part of our national interest, too, I think, to help our friends in Central America, as well as we did in the omnibus appropriation bill that passed last December, to help them build their society out so people can stay home, which I think is something common to all of us, our desire to grow up and to prosper where we live, where we were born. Last Congress, along with Henry Cuellar, I introduced something called the Humane Act relative to this humanitarian crisis of children from Central America that would help us do a better job protecting them once they got here in the United States. It's tragic, I believe, that the children who make it safely into our country are sometimes placed into bad circumstances through a lack of adequate vetting by the sponsors of the people who they're placed with while they're awaiting their immigration court proceedings or what have you. The Humane Act would require all potential sponsors of these children to undergo a rigorous biometric background and criminal history check and would add another essential layer of protection. We can, of course, do more with our friends in Central America to stem the tide of unaccompanied minors, and I know Mexico has done a lot as well. But once these children arrive in the United States, it's my conviction that they are our responsibility to help keep them safe. And I look forward to reintroducing that legislation soon. One final example I'll mention is the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. Many of you are aware that in New England and diverse parts of the United States, there's an opioid prescription drug abuse problem that's resulted in overdoses and people becoming addicted to the prescription drugs. When those aren't available, they will then convert to heroin. And again, I know the challenge is for the United States and Mexico is, of course, the United States is the demand side of this, as my Mexican friends point out. And it would make life easier in Mexico, particularly dealing with the cartels and the criminal organizations that profit from the illegal drug trade, if the United States was able to do more on the demand side. And they're absolutely right. But in 2014 alone, drug cartels smuggled more than 250,000 pounds of heroin across the border at a street value of about $25 billion. It's big, big business. And while production has been growing to meet the U.S. demand, unfortunately, U.S. efforts to interdict those drugs have fallen short. So listening to some of our law enforcement personnel and also our military people who, like the recently retired General Kelly, who is head of Southern Command, we need to put more assets in the hands of law enforcement and our military to try to make sure that we help our friends in Mexico and elsewhere interdict these drugs before they get to the United States. Well, I could go on, but I won't. The point is that there are many avenues to work toward a stronger binational and bilateral relationship and a more prosperous future for both the United States and our friends in Mexico. And that's because in the 21st century, securing our border is more than about just immigration. It encompasses everything from humanitarian disasters to terrorist threats. And I'm hopeful we can continue to work together and keep our heads about us while there are some who appear to be losing theirs in the process, because it is in our mutual national interest to make our border safer and more economically vibrant. And as I said, the truth is our success in the United States depends in significant part upon Mexico's success. And when we're both prospering, the communities along the border do too. So, Mr. Ambassador, thank you for having me here in Brookings, and I look forward to our continued conversation. Should have added that last March, when I was in Mexico City, Mr. Ambassador, I was with Senator Tim Kaine from Virginia in the Chamber of Commerce sponsoring a breakfast, and had all of these U.S. oil and gas companies meeting in Mexico City to try to learn more about the change in Mexican approach to international private investment in the huge energy resources in Mexico. So as Mexico develops its energy resources with the aid of more private investment, and of course under the auspices of domestic law, I think there's a great opportunity for economic growth and jobs and greater prosperity. So I was encouraged to see that.
As I mentioned, as I threw out there the idea of Texas being a spark plug in the U.S.-Mexico bilateral relationship, and when you look at the landscape of structural reform in Mexico today, there's clearly no issue that could become a renewed driver of engagement between Texas and Mexico than obviously the energy reform. Obviously, the international prices of oil have not helped Mexico deliver upon some of the potential and the promise of structural reforms. There will be a very important milestone on its way as we head into the latter part of the year when the Mexican government announces the tender process for the deep water deposits, which is where I think a lot of the potential private investment attraction and interest and appetite will be. And that will be a very important moment, and obviously a lot of Texan firms and corporations or headquartered in Texas will play a very important role. But yes, that is one issue that I think can sort of galvanize this strategic relationship that has occurred historically between Texas and Mexico, despite Sam Houston and the Alamo. I was going to spare you the issues of the world, but as I heard you throw it out there, I I'm biting my lips, and I'm just going to say that the only place where we actually do need a wall is around Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue with Trump inside. But there's a saying in this city that you know very well, which is that, you know, politics stops at the water's edge. In the case of the Texas-Mexico relationship, it's not the Atlantic, it's not the Pacific, it's actually the Rio Grande. But it speaks profoundly as to why Texas, with both Republican and Democratic governors, and Richards and George W. Bush, has played such an important role as a leader in driving the direction, the traction of this bilateral relationship. But somehow, and I may be wrong, I haven't been I haven't been traveling to Texas as often as I did when I was the ambassador, but something tells me that we may have lost a bit, and the rhetoric and the narrative that has been triggered by particularly one of the contenders in the GOP today has sort of set back some of the perceptions of how our citizens understand this bilateral relationship. How do we, in this context, sort of ensure that we can continue to win the hearts and minds of this huge trans-border community, which is in and of itself a reality that most in Washington, D.C. And Mexico City don't get and don't understand?
Well, 38% roughly of my constituents in Texas are Hispanic, and of course, many of them have family on both sides of the border, or certainly came from south of the border. So,
or the border crossed them in after 1847.
Well, like I said, we have history. But the point is that these are folks in our communities that go to our schools, that we go to church with. I mean, this is just that we work alongside, and so this is not dealing with some other group, or these are my fellow Texans. And so I think part of, as you know, part of my background comes from law enforcement as Attorney General of Texas and a judge for 13 years. So I have very strong conviction that the rule of law is very, very important. And I think part of what you see is the reaction, particularly in the context of the border and immigration generally, is a sense that we've kind of, the United States has lost its way when it comes to the rule of law. And I think once people have the confidence that, okay, we have the law, we have the rules, and the rules will be observed, and people who don't play by the rules will be held accountable, then I think we can begin to restore public's confidence in it. Because the United States is the most generous country in the world when it comes to our immigration policy. We naturalize almost 1 million people a year, including a lot of people from Mexico. So, but I think as long as people are feeling insecure, either in their person or in their job, and they have the sense that, well, the rules that used to apply no longer apply, and they're looking around to say, well, who can I hold accountable for reestablishing some order out of this chaos, I think you get a situation like we have now.
However, one could argue that there are, in my view at least, there are two pivotal moments in the recent history of Mexico and the United States that have profoundly changed the dynamics of the U.S.-Mexico bilateral relationship. And Michael, I apologize, but I don't agree with the perception that the U.S.-Mexico agenda was an automatic pilot before 2013. I disagree vehemently with that perception, but the first one was NAFTA, which, as you mentioned, profoundly changed the way both countries engage with one another economically and in terms of our joint supply and production platforms. And therefore, when Mr. Trump talks about, you know, putting duties and tariffs on U.S. exports, he forgets that 42 cents of every $1 of Mexican exports is U.S. content, so it's an own goal that he's scoring against U.S. businesses and U.S. manufacturing. But NAFTA was a very profound shift in the way Mexico and the United States engaged. But the second one, which a lot of people still haven't sort of processed, is 9/11. Because after 9/11, Mexico and the United States started working in a way which, despite the challenges of a border like the one that we share, despite the real issues and dangers that exist because of the topographic, geographic nature of our border, Mexico and the United States would be working hand-in-hand to ensure that potential terrorists, particularly, don't use our common border to undermine the security of the United States. And in many ways, even though this may not be very popular to say in Mexico, Mexico has been watching the U.S.'s back since 9/11 when it comes to international terrorists. How do we convey... one of the things that I always fought with as an ambassador was, how do we inject these changes and this data and this narrative into two... We've got loonies on our side, too. They run in the best of families. But how do we use the bully pulpit to talk about how profoundly this relationship has changed? And that doesn't mean that everything is peachy and rosy. There are issues, there are challenges. There are many things that need to be improved on both sides of the border. You've mentioned the perceptions of insecurity, or an issue that Michael mentioned, which in my view is probably one of the most persistent challenges to Mexico's image in the United States, which is endemic corruption and impunity prevalent in Mexico. This doesn't mean that we have a peachy and rosy world, but there is a profound change that has been occurring in the bilateral relationship over the past 20 years. How do you go to your state and to the districts that you go to and tell people about this profound change that has occurred without people saying, this is crap?
Well, some of them will say that.
Okay. I heard it on the road for 6 years, believe me.
Or some won't listen, but there are. I like to think there are enough people that will listen that you can't give up trying to provide facts and a reasoned argument. But I would say Mexico and the United States have worked very closely together on terrorism and on security issues. I know this is a little bit. We don't talk about some of this because, frankly, I know Mexico gets a little sensitive when they see their neighbors to the north sort of exerting themselves. And obviously, there's a lot of pride and a lot of history, and Mexico's entitled to make decisions within its borders as a sovereign nation, and not without regard to what the United States may think. But the fact of the matter is, there has been a lot of work and a lot of cooperation there. On the trade part, I think this is a kind of a mystery to me, because NAFTA is not a dirty word in Texas. People view it as a benefit, and that we're the number one exporting state in the country, which is a reason why we continue to add jobs. One reason we continue to add jobs. And a lot of that's with, of course, between our two countries. So that's one reason I've been an advocate of Trade Promotion Authority and now the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will soon come over to the Senate. That's going to be a challenge in this political environment.
Yeah.
It may mean that it does not get taken up before the election, but that's one reason why I fought for the Trade Promotion Authority, because it's a six-year authorization, and we need to do this deal, because obviously China is going to set the rules in Asia if we don't, and I see this as something that will benefit both of our countries. But we have to also admit, I think, that the benefits of trade don't fall evenly. Because there are some places, I'll just say, for example, the textile industries in South Carolina and elsewhere. When you opened up places in Central America and elsewhere that could do it cheaper and more efficiently, well, those jobs went there. That causes dislocation, which is real and which we need to pay attention to, which is right. We had... Trade Assistance Authority, which provided additional benefits and job training for people who did lose jobs as a result of the movement of their industry to some place that could operate more efficiently. So I just think we need to keep trying, and we need to keep
banging the drum.
We don't give up trying to provide those facts and those reasoned explanations.
Talking of, I've been given the 5-minute mark, so I'll be very brief and try and see if we can squeeze in a couple of questions from the audience. Talking about the issue of winning hearts and minds, you've been a voice of reason in getting a U.S. ambassador to Mexico confirmed, Roberta Jacobson, who is uniquely qualified to be the United States ambassador to Mexico. The problem is that many in Mexico don't understand how Washington works, don't understand the politics of how nominations work their way through the Senate. And the perception generally in Mexico is that because we're now 5 months and counting without the U.S. ambassador there, that the U.S. has no skin in the game. Can you share with us your perceptions as to how this process, especially after what happened last night, may move forward in the coming weeks?
Yeah, certainly. This isn't about Mexico. This is about Cuba. And Ms. Jacobson's work there on behalf of the administration. To be honest, I've talked to Senator Menendez, for example, from New Jersey, who's not excited about the nomination, and he's been one of the ones that's put a hold on it. My understanding, he's now changed his perspective. He'll allow a vote. And certainly, I intend to reach out to Senator Rubio, who I think is the other person who has a hold on the nomination. We are trying to work with them and with the White House to try to bring Ms. Jacobson's nomination up for a vote. I agree with you that our relationship is simply too important to leave that position vacant any longer. But that's been our challenge. So we are working on it. There is a bipartisan effort working with the White House to try to get that vote. And I believe if the vote is held, she will be confirmed.
And mind you, I'm not putting you on the spot. I'll be an equal opportunity cheerleader here. It took us 6 months to designate ours, so we're more or less on level. On a level playing field, but are there any questions from the audience? Yes. And could you please sort of provide us with your name and affiliation if there's one?
Hi, I'm Paola. I'm a George Washington student, and I'm from Texas. And my question is with regards to illegal gun trafficking. So what's going on from the U.S. to Mexico? I want to know, given the whole rise in advocacy for more gun more gun rights in Texas. How will this affect the illegal gun trafficking back to Mexico, Central America, Colombia, and so on?
Well, obviously, the United States and Mexico have very different views about private ownership of guns. We have a constitutional amendment. We have a lot of debates between ourselves here about the scope of appropriate regulation of gun ownership and rights, but we are united in our efforts to block as many of those guns coming, particularly from straw purchasers, through our ports of entry south. This is a huge problem. Those guns don't just come from the United States. They come from around the world as well. And I know this has been a subject we've talked about a lot over time, and I just think we come from very different perspectives given the constitutional protections under our laws and just a very different point of view that we just have to continue to try to work with and manage. But clearly we are united in our desire and our efforts to try to prevent those guns coming from particularly straw purchasers back into Mexico. One reason I was particularly outraged by the Fast and Furious initiative by the Justice Department, and why I push so hard to get answers is I think, you know, this is just a dumb idea to allow these purchases to take place and then to try to hope to catch up with them at some point and then to get the larger network. But I don't know, Mr. Ambassador, you probably have a different point of view, but I do believe we are united in our desire to keep those guns from going south.
I'll just very quickly say that, again, as in most things in the U.S.-Mexico bilateral relationship, you need to detangle. And whereas we have put pressure, obviously, on the United States to curtail the flow of guns and to shut down some of the loopholes that allow guns to be illegally purchased in the United States and illegally cross over a border, I always said as an ambassador that despite what I may feel about gun rights in the United States, it's not my role to challenge the Constitution or the sovereign rights of the American people. What I would say is that I am convinced that the Founding Fathers didn't draft the Second Amendment to allow guns to be illicitly bought in the United States and illicitly trafficked over an international border, and that's what we've been asking the U.S. government to do. But Mexico also has a responsibility in how it modernizes its customs agency so that it no longer is just a revenue agency, but it becomes a law enforcement agency that can stop those guns from crossing into Mexican territory also. But we have time for one last question. Yep, Chris. And just identify yourself.
Yeah, Chris Wilson from the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. You mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership as an important, you know, sort of step forward in the trade architecture for the Americas, for the Pacific, with Mexico and Canada, our biggest trading partners. I wonder if you could just walk us through your sort of legislative outlook for when we might see a vote on that. Are we still sort of headed towards perhaps a lame duck vote, or what's your outlook for the...
Well, I wouldn't anticipate a vote before the election. Let me just put it that way, particularly when you have the leading candidates of both political parties very negative on the whole trade idea. There also are, which I happen to disagree with, but that's the political environment we're in. I think there are some specific issues that are problematic, even for those of us who voted for trade promotion authority, particularly the shortened protection for patents. In the biologics area, there were some areas that are particularly disturbing to some regions of the country, like our friends in North Carolina on the tobacco issue. And you have things like that are sector specific in the ag sector, like dairy and the like, which are always challenges in these trade deals. It's amazing to me that any trade deal is ever done, given the complexity of these. But we have done it. We can do it. And I think we should continue to work our way through this and get this one done. There are some who just simply will never convince. But I think there's a very good argument. And, in fact, you don't have to just tell people, well, trust us. You can show them the impact it's made on a region and on countries. And I just think that it would be a terrible shame for us not to pursue the Trans-Pacific Partnership because you're going to default the rules to China. And I think we have a very big national interest to make sure that doesn't happen.
With that, please join me in thanking a true statesman and a true friend of the Mexican history.
Thank you, Senator Cornyn. Thank you, Ambassador Sarikhan. And thank you all on behalf of the Brookings Institution, the American Society, Council of the Americas, for joining us here today. Please take a look at some of our materials that are available outside, including my latest book. And that's the second plug. And again, thank you so much for a very enlightening conversation here today.
Thanks a lot. You got to check that book out.
Oh, we're curious.